Hello and welcome to Cruise Club. We've got the need to podcast. This is episode 22. Ooh, so many twos. 22, Mission Impossible 2 from 2000. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
So Mike, welcome to the 2000s. We are here in a new decade, a new century, a new millennium, ready to crack off the back half of Cruise Club. We are officially, this movie, so you know, marks the halfway point of what he has released so far, like to date, up to the time we record this episode. Tom Cruise has put out 44 films.
Wow.
This is our 22nd episode. We are halfway home in Cruise Club. Wow. Congratulations, we've made it halfway.
We are living on a prayer, my friend.
Living on a prayer. With us today, also living on that same titular prayer, he's back from his cocktail episode. He's also been on our Hanks and the Memories episode, our podcast, a couple times. With us tonight is Austin Wolf Southern. Hello, Austin.
Hi. How are you? Thank you
so much for joining us. Because this is the big franchise. I was thinking today, obviously we have Too Fast, Too Forever, and that's talking about, you know, possibly the biggest franchise in the world that isn't Marvel. Of the podcasts that you and I have done, Mike, The Matrix is probably the closest in terms of, like, number of movies, but, like, this is, I think I'm coming to terms with the fact that, especially after we did an entire run of Cage Club, where Nicolas Cage is sort of famous-ish for not wanting to do sequels, really, like, he has a couple of Ghost Riders and a couple of National Treasures, and he's gonna do a second Croods movie, but, like, got almost 100 movies and, like, three sequels, like, for someone so against sequels to have a movie like this, or have a franchise like this, where we're gonna see Ethan Hunt eight times or whatever, right? Like, it's crazy.
Yeah, and that's what's different about this and The Matrix too. I feel like that stopped and this is still going. I mean, The Matrix,
well,
Matrix
may
be coming back. I mean, there's a glitch. Yeah, you know,
deja vu.
As it were, like, this franchise, you know, is still up and running and still a strong contender. I feel like going back to revisit these first two movies, I like them way more now than I think I ever did, and they play better every time I watch them, and I feel like that's going to keep happening with these movies, and I know I love the rest of the franchise, so I think it's just going to be even better, and it's like, I don't know, man, this is tough. Like, this might be the one, you know? Like, it's crazy. I love that we're covering this series, because by the end, I want to know, like, do I love this franchise the most? That could be, that might be happening here.
I think this is one of the best franchises of all time, and completely solid and consistent. Every movie is special and amazing and so unique in its style, at least up to a certain point. Now they're kind of, you know, feeling similar to each other, but early on they're so different and they're all amazing.
And that's one thing that Mike and I tried to, not that this is any kind of real, you know, great shakes or grand scheme that we're doing, but we're having a different guest for each Mission Impossible movie. So, like, normally we have, like, a franchise. Actually, Mike, you know, we have another franchise on another Tom podcast. We got four Toy Stories coming up, right?
Oh, so that's right,
a pretty sizable chunk too. But for each Mission Impossible movie that has a different director, we have a different guest. So instead of having, like, one person do all the Mission Impossible movies, because it's a sixth or something, or like an eighth of what he's done so far, we're having a different person each time. So Austin is our John Woo Mission Impossible expert. And then once we get to the Christopher McQuarrie ones, I don't remember who the guest is, but we're going to have that same guest for all the McQuarrie ones, because I think it's more consistent there. But you're right, Austin. Like, they are wildly different, but also kind of similar, and they all work on their own and as individuals and also part of a whole and everything. And it's kind of fascinating to look back at this franchise evolving. You know, every five or six episodes, Mike, we're going to have a new Mission Impossible movie to talk about, and that's exciting.
Yeah, and that's what, it's so crazy coming off the last two movies. They're so heavy, really. We had, like, Eyes Wide Shut, and then we had Magnolia, and now we're back to this. It's, like, such a breather, or such, like, a palate cleanser or something, almost. And, like, I had almost forgotten about Ethan Hunt there for a minute, you know, but those two long 3-hour dramas that we went through, it's like, wow, he snapped right back. Like, he's in spy mode, and, like, it's a lot of fun here.
So now, before we get into the discussion of our favorite moments, our least favorite moments, what we thought of this all together, I am going to try to offer a plot summary of Mission Impossible 2, which I think, from what I was reading in the trivia about this movie, people complain that the first one was too complicated, so they really kind of wanted to simplify this. Okay. And so the plot is more straightforward than it was in the first one. There's, I guess, fewer twists and turns. There are still twists and turns. There are, by my count, 5 masks in this movie, which is,
at least,
the most that's ever going to be. But there's a lot of masks.
Yeah, there's a lot of masks. And people generally don't like this entry, like, fans of the series. And I'm happy to to be here for this episode because I love this movie so much. And yeah, this is the one that even people who love this franchise, everyone, or a lot of people kind of hate part two. And it sounds like you guys didn't, which is nice to hear.
Yeah, I remember not liking it when I originally saw it because I found it sort of confusing. And, you know, we'll get into all that kind of stuff later and everything. But now watching it this time, like, it's a completely different type of movie than I thought it was. You know, like, I kind of had to, like, meet it on its level, I guess, this time around. And at that, like, I really had a blast.
Like, I don't think it's as, like, I think I still prefer the first one. This could still be my least favorite of all of them. I mean, I guess we'll see that in, you know, a span of a couple months or whatever as we get to each one individually or progressively, whatever. But I don't think this is bad. And I was looking on Letterboxd at the average ratings of each, and I think the first one and Fallout are the highest rated. And this one is, like, the lowest by almost a full point. But this is, like, an average of, like, 2.5-ish. And I think the next closest is, like, a 3.3 or something. Like, if there's a wide gap between this and the next quote-unquote worst one. Like, people, I think, have decided to write this one off, and I don't know why that is, and I guess we'll get into it. Here's what this movie is about, if you've not seen Mission Impossible 2. So there's a guy in the beginning of the movie who's kind of like the scientist in Hobbs and Shaw. I kept getting so many Hobbs and Shaw flashbacks.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Flashes forward.
Yeah, me too.
He's created a deadly virus, and he injects himself with the virus because he, you know, that's just what he does. And so just like Hattie kind of rescues the virus, we also have later, we have Thandie Newton inject herself, another Hattie move. He injects himself with the virus. He's friends with Ethan. He's like, Ethan, I need help. Ethan's on holiday, as Sir Anthony Hopkins says, so the IMF sends someone who kind of, sort of, maybe looks like him in an Ethan Hunt mask, and he got that guy breaks bad. And so with the help of William Mapother, a.k.a. Tom Cruise's cousin, a.k.a. Ethan from Lost, they kill the scientist, steal the drug, and they're out to make a whole bundle of money. You know, sell this in the black market and make conceivably 37 million pounds, or by the end of the movie, in theory, billions of dollars in stock options. They are here to wreak havoc on the world. So Ethan Hunt, Tom Cruise, off free soloing mountains in Utah somewhere, gets contacted by the IMF to clean up the mess. They say, you can build out a team, but the one person you have to hire is Thandie Newton, a.k.a. Maeve from Westworld, who's basically Catwoman. Like, she's kind of Selina Kyle. She's, like, an attractive, sexy thief who's burgling jewelry, and she's kind of got that whole, like, prowly, I guess it maybe just, you know, a thief vibe. She and Ethan fall in love and have sex almost immediately. Like, it is bananas how fast they have sex. I guess he's Batman? If she's Catwoman, I guess he's Batman. Ethan brings back Luther, brings in a pilot, a helicopter pilot or whatever, named Billy, who was originally going to be, oh, wait, hold on, who was it going to be?
Simon Pegg?
Steve Zahn.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, the American Simon Pegg, I guess. So they bring in those two guys, they go to a horse track, they do some spy stuff, you know, they have this videotape of, like, the drug corporate bio scene or whatever, their plan, they do some spy stuff there, there's a bunch of masks used, Ethan gets away with the antidote, cures, or he breaks into the lab where the bad guys are, things get complicated, a bunch of masks, everybody knows everything, they go to rescue Thandie Newton, Ethan and the bad guy have a motorcycle battle, they jump at each other and they hug each other in midair and they fall off a cliff, and Ethan shoots and kills him, and then they go away on vacation, he and Thandie Newton, to be in love forever. I guess similar to Batman and Selina Kyle, you know, having tea in Paris somewhere, they have a romantic getaway. And apparently she was going to be back for the third one, but she decided to focus on her family instead of act, so she sort of got written out of the franchise. But it seems like she's going to be kind of his love interest or whatever, but I guess she's going to be replaced by Michelle Monaghan? Is that who it is?
Yeah.
But Michelle Monaghan isn't like a thief or anything, so I think they could bring this character back eventually.
They sure could, but her character not only doesn't come back, but has never even gets mentioned in any of the future movies. Like, she's been completely erased from the franchise, which
and
is
Anthony
really
Hopkins
unfortunate.
Comes back either, right?
I was just gonna say, no. Anthony Hopkins.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
He gets replaced with Alec Baldwin, I think, eventually, right? As the head of the IMF or
yeah,
whatever it is. Yeah.
So the crazy thing about the Anthony Hopkins role is that it was supposed to be Ian McKellen, but he was doing a play in London. He's like, I can't do it because, like, I'm worried it's going to run long or whatever. And by saying no to the small part, because he would have had to be sort of available, I guess, it let him be both Gandalf and Magneto. He would have had to be neither of those.
Oh, wow.
If he was in this movie, like, even for like the very small, according to IMDb, who knows if that's true or not. And also, the guy who plays Ambrose in this movie was supposed to be Wolverine, was supposed to be Logan, and because this ran long and because that guy got hurt in a motorcycle accident on set, had to drop out, and now, you know, Hugh Jackman is Wolverine forever. You know what I mean? Like, it's just this, it's this weird kind of domino effect that this movie ran super long, way over time, way over budget. You know, there was drama on set. You know, the cinematographer left after like a month. John Woo was not asked back for the third one. Like, there's a lot of things here that seems to not have gone on smoothly behind the scenes, and then here we are with a pretty strong second outing in the Mission Impossible franchise.
I mean, it's so different than any of the other movies. Like, this is the one I feel like that has the director's stamp on it the most. Like, this is a John Woo film, first and foremost. Like, he brought everything. I mean, yeah. this might be, like, the last movie he made in America. I think this is post-Windtalkers or something, or one of the last films he had a chance to. So
I think Windtalkers... it was 2002, maybe?
Oh, okay, yeah, then he threw everything in the kitchen sink at Windtalkers, too. But, like, this is, you know, his very traditional sort of gung-fu romantic cop drama stuff just transplanted into a Mission Impossible movie. And it doesn't exactly fit perfectly. I don't know, as, like, a one-off sort of adventure, I feel like it really works. Like, this is almost like the Temple of Doom Mission Impossible movie, where it could have come maybe even, like, before the last one. It's so, like, in its own world and, like, out of continuity.
Yeah, this is very much a John Woo movie, and that's what's great.
So, Austin, you said you love this movie. I know that you love, I think you love, based on your review, I think you love John Woo. What is your favorite part of this, your favorite moment, your favorite scene? Also, on a grand scale, do you love the Mission Impossible franchise? I think you said you did.
Yeah.
Like, where does this fall in the rankings, and, like, what is your favorite part of this movie?
I saw more flaws in it on this watch than I have previously, but I do think it's one of the best. But, like, Ghost Protocol and Rogue Nation are just kind of on another level, and then the first one is kind of, yeah, the first one and this one I think are on their own level. Yeah, 4 and 5 are sort of its own thing, and Fallout I thought was really good, but I'd like to see it again. The third one I like a lot, but the third one, it's like the fourth Fast and Furious of the franchise, where it's like, when I watch it, I'm like, oh yeah, this is a good movie. But then a week later, I don't remember anything that happened in it. Like, and so I don't know why it doesn't stick with me, but it's just, that's the worst one, quote unquote, worst one for me, just because I never, like, remember it fondly, even though I know it's good. That's similar to Fast and Furious, as I'm sure you're aware of.
Yeah. I think I mentioned on the first go round, the first Mission Impossible movie, Mike, that I was saying that when I watched these movies for the first time, I alternated these with the Scream movies. And so I watched the first four Scream, or all four Scream movies, and the first four of these, like, alternating one night after another. And I don't remember almost anything about this. And I think you and I had the same recollection, is that there's the rock climbing, and that's kind of all I remember. And all I remember about three is Philip Seymour Hoffman is in it, which I only know because of Kyle and Brian. Like, I don't know. These are kind of like a weird blur. Like, I know that I like them, but I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, like, I also did not remember hardly any of this movie. I remembered who was in it, basically. And, like, I thought sequences were from other John Woo films. Like, I thought the car sequence was from another movie. I thought we were going to get a boat sequence in this, but we never do. That's actually in Face Off. Yeah, I feel like with the next one, when we'll get to it, like, when J.J. Abrams came in, like, the consensus was we need to sort of soft reboot, like, this franchise, or at least get it back to basics, and it's way more streamlined, and, like, I feel like from then on it's more quote-unquote grounded. Like, this looks, feels, and is, like, arranged basically almost like none of the other movies in a way. It's like, I don't know, it's way more artistic. It's got all the slow motion, it's got a lot more tricks and things like that, and rocking soundtrack and stuff. So I feel like after this one, they're like, man, maybe we should, like, pull back and simplify this franchise for a while and then, like, ramp it back up.
Yeah,
and I do want to say this is one of my top two favorite John Woo movies where people switch faces.
What is the other one, Austin? Can you enlighten us on that one?
That would be Face Off. One of the obviously number one, because that is one of the best movies ever made.
Of course, I've heard of that one. Did you mention your favorite moment or your favorite part? I know that you like this movie, but, like, if you had to pick a favorite part of this movie, or scene, or a moment, or whatever.
Well, I think the entire first, not like the very after the, like, very intro, which is like the setup part, but, like, once it starts with Tom Cruise, that, like, 20 minutes and him, like, meeting Thandi Newton, like, all of that is just so ridiculous and, like, stylish and over the top and just, like, I just laughed like every minute of something that was happening. And I just loved the entire introduction to this movie. And I mean, if I had to pick a favorite part, maybe it was just like him climbing the mountain and then getting to the top, someone like rocket launches sunglasses to him. And then he like a couple times he like when the thing lands, he's just like, sees that there's sunglasses, and he just does this like scoffing thing that's so funny. And just like,
well, so, I feel like that's a meta joke, because like sunglasses are such a Tom Cruise thing by this point. I think like they've caught on, you know, that he knows.
Well, yeah,
that
that's what's great. Like, I don't know, his response is just really funny. And then when he like takes off the glasses that are about to self-destruct, and he's just like, if you knew where I was, it wouldn't be a holiday. And then he throws the glasses at the camera and it explodes into the opening credits. It's fucking phenomenal. And then just everything with Thandie Newton, because I also want to say, like, this is by far my favorite romance of the franchise. And it's why, okay, I think it's like so unfortunate that she doesn't come back, because this is the only relationship he's had that I'm invested in.
Now, do you think, is it believable to you how quickly they fall in love? And I mean, they're both beautiful people, and they're both, you know, driven, and they're, you know, he catches her in the act. I think there's something sexual about the art of thieving. But do you believe how quickly they fall in love and have sex in this movie?
I don't think you need to believe it. I don't think it's like a believable movie at this point. Their love affair is so goofy. And like just their lines to each other, like everything is just like really silly and goofy. And it's just like, I'm not really thinking about whether it's realistic. I'm just so charmed by how like dumb and silly it is. And it kind of is believable, just of like, yeah, just them being like beautiful people. Like I kind of do believe it. Oh, I know what my favorite part is. She has to like go sleep with the other guy as like part of the mission. And he says like, you know, would it make you feel better if I didn't want you to do this? And she says, yes. And then he screams into her face, feel better. And it's the most romantic moment I've ever seen in a movie. It's so good. It's so aggressive, but like so sweet, hilarious. And I love it.
Their whole relationship is super aggressive, I feel, in the movie. That's why they fall for each other so hard so fast, because like, you know, they're in that tub when they're trying to dodge the like security, when she's lifting the necklace, and it's kind of like feels like an out of sight trunk moment trying to happen. Then he's like posing as the security guard. I like, that's weird. I don't know what's going on there. But then they have like that high speed chase, you know, it's like something straight out of James Bond, where he just like rolls up on her the next day in the on the road, and they get into a high speed chase, and he like saves her life with that crazy John Woo car move. And then they just cut to like having banged. So there must have been something, or they're like making out in the car for a second. So there must have been something about like the adrenaline rush of almost having just died.
Yeah,
and living
absolutely
this like lifestyle together.
And that's a great like action meet cute too, of just like falling in love over a car race.
I mean, also again, very Fast and Furious.
It's true. Yeah.
I do want to say, I think I said, I don't know if it was again on the first Mission Impossible movie, I, you know, I feel like I'm having that Matrix glitch deja vu that you were talking about before, Mike. I don't remember when I said things, but I know I mentioned on some Cruise Club podcast before that the opening mountain climbing scene that Austin, you were talking about, where he's free soloing that cliff face in Utah, and then he gets the missile shot at him, and he just scoffs at it, which, yeah, I just love.
Which is really effective. That rock climbing is really tense and really effective.
So there was a, I don't know if it was Vanity Fair or someone on, like one of those kind of like 10-minute breakdown of scene sort of things on YouTube. They had Alex Honnold, the guy who, the star of Free Solo, I don't know if he's star of a documentary, but the main guy, the guy that they're following in Free Solo. Mm. And he broke down all of these different like rock climbing sequences in movies. And he said that this one is the most believable. Like, he's wearing wires and stuff here, of course he is, but he's actually, that's actually Tom Cruise on the cliff face, and he does, like, again, 95% of his own stunts in this movie. But he was saying that, like, the techniques he's using, the way that he, like, pauses and breathes and, like, holds and rests and everything, like, it's all true to form.
Like, the way he shimmies his foot, there's that great moment where he, like, kicks his leg up and, like, you can see him, like, push his foot into position. It's really cool.
I mean, there's two things that stick out to me. Like, I don't remember that one, I'm sure. Like, I mean, everything about it is just so, like, specifically and wonderfully crafted. But there's the time where he, like, rests his arms by, like, kneeling his knees under that, like, alcove. You know what I mean? He's just like crouching, and then he jumps from one cliff to the other. Which in the video that I was watching, I'm talking about, like, Alex laughed about it. He was just like, yeah, like you wouldn't do that because, like, if you miss, you die. But, like, you know, Ethan Hunt's not going to miss because he's, you know, he's Ethan Hunt. But I just love that it, not only is it awesome and then becomes funny in sort of a self-parody kind of way, but also not. But I also like that it's just, it's authentic and genuine and realistic. Like, it's just so cool. It's such a great way to start the movie.
It's also a great way, quick way to show us, you know, what Ethan's capable of. Like, this is a monumental feat that we're witnessing, you know, of human endurance and perfection or whatever. Like, this guy is beyond us. You know what I'm saying? Like, he is the man for the mission and all that kind of thing. So, like, I'm not worried about him so much in this movie. Like, is he going to die? Is this going to happen? Is he going to get... Like, I know he's going to be okay, and I'm cool with that. Like, I like that for once. Like, I don't have to worry about him.
And I do like that he's such that guy, Mike, that they mention in this, like, you know, Anthony Hopkins explains what he has to do. He's like, that sounds difficult. He goes, well, this is not mission difficult, Mr. Hunt. It's mission impossible. Yes. Difficult should be a walk in the park. Like, yeah, you say it's difficult, but, like, it's doable. Do it. Just get it done. And in the end, like, it's important to remember, not important to remember, but, like, he fails. Like, he's supposed to bring back the sample. He doesn't. And Anthony Hopkins at the end is just like, well, you didn't do your job, man. Like, just come on, like, be better. And I think it's just funny that, like, he literally saves the world from this global pandemic, and yet he still didn't do, you know, daddy's not happy.
I guess he fails in Anthony Hopkins' eyes, but he, like, you know, he intentionally doesn't bring back the virus.
Right. Yeah. Mike, what about you? What is your favorite part? Is it that opening, or is it something else about this movie that you love more than anything else?
It might be Sean's house, the villain. No, even though that house is amazing. And I was getting a real sort of GoldenEye vibe off of this, too, where it's like the evil James Bond, being like the evil Ethan Hunt here. I love all that kind of stuff about the bad guy, but my favorite part is just everything from when he gets on that motor... At the end, he, like, puts on the sunglasses again and gets on that motorcycle, and then it's just, like, 20 minutes of, like, some of the most amazing, awesome action stuff, like, I've seen in a really long time.
Yeah.
This is why John Woo's, like, a master. This is why you sort of put up with a lot of his, like, melodramatic crappiness sometimes. Like, he's a very weird filmmaker for American audiences, I feel like. He shoves a lot of, like, soap operatic kinds of things into his... And it's great. I love that stuff, but I feel like that's why he's not liked as much. But, like, you cannot deny this action stuff, and knowing that it's, like, and seeing that it's Tom Cruise, like, driving through giant flames and stuff, I just love all of his drifting and shooting and all of that crap. Like, it's just amazing, like, all the way up to the end here. So, like, I was just riveted. Like, I was with this movie and having, like, a lot of fun and being like, oh, it's, like, kind of goofy, it's silly, it's, like, takes itself seriously sometimes but knows when not to. This happens and I'm like, no, this movie's, like, legit. I really like this movie now.
You know, I love that end too. I love the motorcycle stuff. I was getting, again, flashes forward to Fallout because there's great motorcycle stuff in that too, which we will get to. I love that. I think my favorite part that we've not really gone too into depth yet, because I love the opening, I love that ending. Austin mentioned this, but I love the kind of the meet cute between him and Thandi Newton, like her stealing the jewelry from that bathtub, from the bathroom, and him just being there, like helping her escape. Like, there's just such a charm to all of that. That I just, it's kind of effortless. And I mean, it's, again, two likable actors, two beautiful actors hitting it off and, like, developing this rapport and this chemistry. And I think it goes into, like, I can see what you're saying, Austin, the romance you feel the most connected to in the franchise, because, like, there is a connection there between the two of them. And I think that one scene in the bathroom, it might be, like, what, 3 or 4 minutes? But, like, it's kind of all you need. It's like, oh, yeah, these two are, they're kind of meant to be together.
Yeah, they have really good chemistry. And I think just the next one, you know, Michelle Monaghan is who he ends up marrying, and it's like an okay relationship, but I mean, in the third one, like, she doesn't know what he does, and that just is too weird for me. Like, you can't have a working relationship if you don't even know your husband is a spy. I mean, she doesn't have to know the details, but, like, she doesn't know he's, like, risking his life, and that's just, like, I don't know, it's very... seems gross to me. And then even when she finds out, I just didn't buy it. I don't like that relationship. And then in Fallout, they kind of imply that he's maybe going to be in a relationship with Rebecca Ferguson, but I just don't see it. Like, I love her in the movies so much, but I don't think there needs to be a romance there. I think that kind of spoils something. So this is, you know, someone who's in his field a little bit, knows what he does, and has this real, like, chemistry with him, and she's just, like, perfect. And, yeah, I think it might be too late to bring her back this much later, but it bums me out that she's not mentioned again.
But I do feel like Ethan is, to a certain extent, kind of always haunted by the ghosts of his past, and, like, I could totally see them, in a way. Like, I guess the bigger question is, like, will people remember her?
That's probably a
good portion of the audience that has come on just like in the Macquarie years, you know, like these movies that, like, I think the franchise has always been big and always received acclaim, but I feel like the most recent few, especially in terms of the scale and the size of the stunts, has really pushed extra eyes to these movies. Narratively, it works. I guess we're in agreement that, like, I don't know if it works for the audience, because we talk about it again to bring up the Fast and the Furious, like Joe and I over on Too Fast, Too Forever, like, would love to have that people bring back, you know, Twinkie or Sean or whoever from, like, Tokyo Drift,
right.
But, like, people who are watching Hobbs and Shaw or Fate of the Furious, like, for the most part, probably don't know who those people are. Mm-hmm. Like, they don't know Carter Verone. Like, they don't know these people that are, like, key elements of the early movies that, like, diehard fans would know, but...
Yeah, and, you know, it's a shame. It is, because I feel like this is something this franchise could use that something like the Bond franchise kind of can. It's like he's sort of with a different girl every movie, and here you could have had like a cool two or three movies with him and his girlfriend or wife or whatever, and they're on missions together, you know, and then eventually you could like sort of play them against each other or something. And she even says something in this movie, she says like To Catch a Thief or something like that, and there's vibes there too, and like those old timey jewel heist movies where they're sort of played against each other but falling in love, and it's like a game of cat and mouse and all that kind of thing. So like, even if I agree it's too late to really bring her back for this reason, but like it's an element that maybe they could play with later on if they ever hand the franchise off to another actor or actress or something like that. It's something in their bag that they could go back into early parts of the lore or parts of the mythology and be like, oh, like it's there, like, you know, let's try and see if it'll still work now.
Yeah, I mean, I think Rebecca Ferguson should take over the franchise if Tom Cruise retires from it. And yeah, have her, like, meet a love interest in a similar style, you know, and it could work.
Now, on the other side of the coin, Austin, in terms of the things that you didn't like, because you said that you saw more flaws in it this time than you had in previous viewings, what about this movie doesn't work for you? Do you have a least favorite part? Is there something about this that you would either remove or change? Also, one thing I want to point out is that apparently the original cut, John Woo's original version of this, was 3.5 hours long. And so Paramount...
I believe it.
Is it Paramount? Who's
I would watch
this?
It.
I would watch it too, for sure. But Paramount said, no, 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 it has to be 2 hours or under. So he cut out almost half the movie. And that's why, like, things early on, I guess there's, like, plot holes and things don't quite make sense. And we're kind of jumping from thing to thing. And I think, I don't know that it's supposed to be as either intentionally or unintentionally funny as, you know, Austin and us, as we find it. But I think it's just kind of... It's the victim of being basically half a movie, and I don't know. Mm. But this time around, Austin, what about this movie did not work for you? Is there, like, what would you change? What would you remove? What would you sub out?
I mean, what didn't work for me is I did feel like Naya, Thandi Newton's character, just didn't really have anything to do in the second half. She doesn't really do much. Like, once she injects herself with the virus, maybe she's feeling sick or something, but she just kind of, like, looks forlorn for, like, the rest of the movie. That just, like, kind of stood out to me a little more. I was like, oh, she was such an exciting character when she's introduced, and, you know, I just wish she had more to do. I don't love the villain, the guy who played the villain. He's fine, he's adequate, but, like, doesn't really, he's not, like, memorable to me. And I think it was a missed opportunity not to have William Mapother be his double. They say, like, oh, he doubled you because he kind of looks like you. And it's like, well, that should have been his cousin playing yeah. that role. And I think, you know, I liked him on Lost. Like, I think he would have been maybe a better villain, and that would have been kind of a fun thing to play with. They sort of look like each other.
I do love his bleach blonde hair in this movie, too. Like, that is a startling look
yeah.
for Ethan.
Oh, yeah. And also, I think Tom Cruise's hair is a character in this movie. And that is another great thing that John Woo added. My least favorite part of this movie is that Naya is not in the next one.
Yeah, that's fair. Would it have been better or worse in your eyes if, when she injects herself, that Tom Cruise kills her? Because she wants to be killed. She's like, kill me, let's get rid of the virus. And he says, no, I'll save you. And then he escapes. Like, if he had killed her there, would you think that would have worked narratively or no?
No, he would never do that. No, I don't think Ethan Hunt would ever let that
be
an option.
So what would you have her do in the back half? Instead of just, like, wandering around aimlessly around Sydney and trying to not kill or not infect other people, Like, what would you have her do to give her sort of a sense of purpose in the back half?
Once Luther gets her and she's in the helicopter, if she could have joined that fight. I don't know. I guess she's not really set up as a fighter. I don't have the idea for what she could have done, but I just would have liked to have seen her do something. Or maybe just, like, struggling. Maybe a scene of her, like, sitting with a gun, like, thinking about killing herself, dealing with, like, what she might have to do. Just something like that. I don't know.
The difficulty of it is that she's set up as a thief, right? And, like, that pays off at the racetrack when she steals the memory card and then she gets his demon, right?
But, like, that could also be my least favorite part, because her putting it in the wrong jacket pocket, I didn't buy. I don't think she would. Yes. I don't think she would make that mistake.
That's only there to be narrowed. But, I mean, she can still put it in the same pocket and he can still notice it, right? Like, he doesn't have to.
Exactly. Like, yeah.
Because you see the face, the cutaway. Yeah, I don't know.
That really bothered me, because I didn't understand why her character would make that mistake. It didn't seem believable to me.
Mike, what about you? What is your least favorite part, and what do you think about the Thandie Newton in the back half? Do you think that it works, or what would you have done to improve that? And then, you know, is there anything else about the movie that you would have changed?
I agree with the Thandie Newton stuff. I was like, where is she? What's going on? Like, I almost expected her to be on the back of Ethan's motorcycle the whole time, you know? Like,
yeah.
He's got her trying to protect her, and she's, like, halfway there, but still shooting people, you know? Like, hanging on and trying to kick ass or something. Or it does just seem like she disappears, and then she shows up in the middle of nowhere, like, in the desert, about to jump off a cliff. I'm like, oh, no.
Yeah, just have her be involved somehow.
My least favorite part here is Billy, this special agent. Like, this guy just vanishes. I mean, he never comes back either in the franchise.
That's
and
true.
I was like, who is this bloke? like, I actually love that it takes place in Sydney, Australia, and I get, you know, they have, like, agents all over the world and stuff like that. The actor was just, like, a nobody for such a big or pivotal role. You know, like, last time, they made sure that his team were somebody's. Right? Like, we had Jean Reno and everything, and, you know, I'd be banging his back, Joey. Mm-hmm. We got Ving Rhames returns. So it would have been cool if there was, you know, like, they said Steve Zahn was supposed to play this role. Like, that would have worked, just because he's a personality I like, that I know from other stuff, that every time he pops up, it would have been like, oh, sweet, and, like, perked me up when he's, like, doing his thing. That was a bit of a bummer.
It was interesting, like, watching this for, like, the second or third time, and then he's introduced, and I'm like, who? Like, who's this guy? Like, I have no memory of him whatsoever.
And I almost thought they were going to pull the thing where, like, he's a mole. Like, they're going to do, oh, like, because we don't know who this guy is, like, he's going to turn out to be a bad person or whatever, and he even flies the helicopter. Yeah, I just feel like he's, like, a total waste, unfortunately. So, like, that, I decided this go-around. I was like, you know, you could have just even omitted that guy, and it could have been him and Luther, or, like, gotten someone to play that role that everybody's sort of familiar with, just to make it pop.
You know, I agree with that. I think my sort of struggle, my least favorite part of the movie, aside from what you guys had mentioned, is I think the final battle in the sand until the end is kind of anticlimactic. Like, I think the action getting there is so good. Mm-hmm. And then when they're actually just, like, basically kind of slapping each other in the sand, like, it just feels like there should be more. The final moment where, you know, Ethan tosses the vials to Luther and then kicks the gun up in the air. Like, I remember that shot where he kicks it up and then shoots... Yeah. You know, shoots Ambrose. Like, that's
and
cool.
And his hair is, like, spinning in the wind as he turns.
Shout out to the fourth character, the fifth character. Yeah. Just like New York, is Ethan's hair. There should be more. And I don't know if, like, they had narratively or creatively kind of shot their shot or whatever, like, to get to that point. But it feels like have it ends, like, have him sort of die. I don't know. Like, it just feels like you have such high highs. And then, like, it feels content to slow it down. And it doesn't exactly work. Like, I feel like comparing this to Face Off, there's so much that happens. You're like, oh, now we're in a boat chase. Like, where did this come from? Like, there's, like, a whole, like, another action sequence. And I don't need, like, a whole other thing here, but I just feel like we need something else in place of this. Like, I think we need something that's just a little bit more energy, just because it feels like kind of like this is it.
Yeah, it is kind of weird that it all comes down to, like, a fist fight. I was thinking, well, like, huh, after all this, like, extreme, elaborate action ballet, like, they're just gonna, like, box or something? Like, what is this? Like, what? I really wanted it to end, like, more in a spectacular fashion. Like, you know, he accidentally, like, blows them up or something, like you know, with a grenade, or like hits him with the motorcycle and like drives over his face, anything, right? But like it was just, it kind of felt abrupt, like we hit a stop sign or something, and they're just gonna throw down in the sand. And I was like, yeah, that's a little irksome.
I mean, like, it didn't like ruin the movie, but I was just like, I kind of wish that it had more. Like, especially, I guess, knowing the action of the first one, like having like the train sequence at the end, and then knowing where this is gonna go, it just feels like we had such a great run of like the 10 or 15 or 20 minutes of, you know, Mike, like what you had mentioned before about like the motorcycle chase and the cars and everything.
The smoke and,
like,
screen and all that stuff.
Like it's so cool, and then it isn't anymore.
I wonder if it was just, if this is like a, I think this might be like a John Woo thing where it's like, because in a lot of his movies, it's like, we're the same, you and me. Like when the cop meets the killer, it's like, we're two sides of the coin. And so this could just be like a symbolic moment where it's like primal hand-to-hand combat, like the yin and the yang, like going, I'm not even joking. Like this is what I actually think, like, my interpretation of this is now is like more like that than literal. You know, it's not supposed to be a big flashy thing, it's just supposed to be like rough and raw.
I don't think you're wrong.
I was also getting other Fallout flash forwards, and I don't want to keep, you know, referencing a movie that we have not talked about, we're not going to talk about for 6 months or whatever, but like when they're in the hospital room and Ethan's in the mask to like play tricks, like he's like, I'm the scientist, I'm still alive. He's like, you died. Like I was getting like in Fallout where there's the Wolf Blitzer thing where they have the guy in the bed, right? Like it's just the same kind of like guy, like, you know, at his lowest, like not paralyzed in bed, but like trapped in bed, stuck in bed, and then just being fed lies to like extract the truth, and just like, wow. Man, like they're going to use this exact thing in four movies and it's going to work again.
That's right out of the playbook. There.
Yeah.
It's like page 47.
Also, him being suspended, you know, like he is in the first movie, that that recurs in, I think, all of them.
I was surprised to learn that they didn't think he went rogue in this one, you know, because the guy on the plane was wearing his mask and he crashed that commuter airline like into a mountain. So like that's insane that that happened. And that sort of news clip reminds me of Joey in the first one where they see his mom and uncle get arrested for like 2 minutes, where it's just like these weird crazy events are happening in the real world while Ethan Hunt is like on a whole other level trying to prevent the end of the world.
This is apparently the only movie, according to IMDb, that he either doesn't go rogue or isn't disavowed. Like, it's the only one where he's, like, kind of in good standing for the entire movie.
Yeah.
Like, everything else, like, something breaks bad in one way or another.
He disappoints the IMF.
He gets a spanking.
Yeah, they're not thrilled with him, but, yeah, he's not kicked out.
This movie not only has the John Woo symbolic doves, because there's a dove that gives Tom Cruise's location away. It also has pigeons, like, in the dove-like slow-mo birds flapping
their
wings.
Same sort of fashion.
Yeah, a lot of pigeons.
Yeah, but that dove is like mythical in this movie. I saw that and I could not contain myself because it's clearly like a CG, not CG, but it's like it looks superimposed and it's got like this glow around it. And I know, you know, John Woo is a very religious person. And so like there's definitely like, here comes Jesus to save the day is what I was like going through my mind.
That's his trademark. I'd be disappointed if there wasn't a dove in this movie.
But I just mean in that way, like it looked like a tattoo came to life or something, you know, where like the dove like started glowing and flew toward the screen and like right behind him, like Tom Cruise appears and just gives like this like quick glance and stuff. And I was just like, this is magic is what's happening now.
Yeah, it's great.
You know, just like another John Woo flourish that I liked. I think it's in that final, the motorcycle chase or whatever, but there's this one shot where like there's the car going around him and he's on the motorcycle. He's like doing like the front, I guess it's like a front wheelie, like a nosy.
Is that
whatever.
Like an endo or something?
It might be. And like the camera is like spinning around like really fast around him as he is spinning and the car is spinning out. Like it's just beautiful. Like it kind of, it's like it's excess for excess sake, but it works, and it's just, it's lovely. It's great.
I love when he causes the smoke screen by hitting the brakes, and then they go through the intersection, and the fucking semi just crashes into the bad guys. This is so awesome.
A couple of little bits of trivia about this. Nicole Kidman was the one who suggested Thandie Newton, because they co-starred in the movie Flirting in 1991. And so she was cast even before they wrote the script.
Yeah, because they're both Australian.
Oh, there we go. That makes sense.
Yeah, Flirting's in an indie Australian movie. It's good.
I wonder if that's why this is shot in Sydney, maybe to like, she's from there, like it makes kind of sense, like let's, I don't know, a lot of times
why not make her Australian then?
Oh, I guess, oh, she wasn't? I just kind of assumed that she was in the movie because it took place there. It's like, we went to her, that's her home turf.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know.
No, because they find her in Barcelona.
Oh, they did find her in Barcelona.
John Woo apparently wrote the script to, or like, the script was written because John Woo was like, this is an action scene, the kind of action scene I want to direct. Write this into the movie because I have an idea how to direct it. So it was just like a kind of a storyboard into script idea, I guess.
Well, you know what's wild about you saying that there's like a 3.5 hour first cut or whatever like that? Like, I feel like the script to this is like 60 pages and like all of the slow-mo and different frame rate and just like length and excess of like sequences and stuff. Like, things are so drawn out. And like, I love that about this movie, but it just feels like very, very, very little actually happens or is like going on that like someone could probably make this in under like an hour and 15 minutes or an hour and a half or something. Like, I love the way it's constructed, don't get me wrong, but I just noticed, I was like, it's weird how like things just feel really drawn out all the time. It's not bothering me, but it's just interesting.
Well, there's a lot of slow-mo. There's a lot of literal drawing it out with the slow
right.
motion
yes.
shots.
Yes, and multiple angles of the same shot. You know, like a car can't just blow up once. It has to blow up from like three different perspectives. So
this movie was delayed because Eyes Wide Shut took so long to film. So like they had to wait for Tom Cruise to become available and become free again to shoot this. And then this ran
to
late.
To grow his hair out.
Because of, like, everything. And so Thandi Newton had to drop out of Charlie's Angels because she was doing this because it ran long. Because it ran long, Tom Cruise, because of his like back end deal or whatever, like because he got so many points on the back end, had to pay for all of the shooting, like the over, like, or I don't know if he had to or he just did, or I don't know what the actual,
oh, wow,
like,
he paid for like the reshoots and stuff.
He paid for like the overshot, but that they also said that between his salary and how much he made on the back end, he still made like $75 million from this movie. So like he was fine. This is like the highest grossing movie in 2000. So, I mean, it was, he did fine. We should not, you know, feel bad for Mr. Cruise. Oh, Thandi Newton was in Interview with the Vampire with Tom Cruise. And she will obviously go back to be in Westworld with Anthony Hopkins.
Did we miss her in Interview with the Vampire? I don't recall her being in that movie.
I remember her being there, I think. When I read it, I was like, oh yeah, but I don't remember who.
Oh, she's not a vampire, though. Like, she wasn't in, I don't know.
Sounds really early for her.
Yvette.
Oh, I think she was Emile, one of the two girls that Tom Cruise might be eating on the love seat. I don't know if you remember that sequence. But
very possible. Let me see if I can find this on Google Images. Yes. I see a picture of of Tom Cruise carrying her lifeless body. So I guess she was eaten for sure.
Oh, what's up? The guy that he kidnaps and pretends when he's like telling him about the Crimea virus thing, that the redhead guy, he comes back. He's in Edge of Tomorrow, right? He's the guy.
Oh.
He's like the general who like puts him, like demotes him and sends him to like the place where he'll live tomorrow forever. Yes.
Okay.
Sends him to the edge.
My last little bit of trivia about this is that in the end, in that final sand battle where Ambrose has the knife by Tom Cruise's eye, they wanted to use a prop knife for obvious reasons because it's an eye and it's a knife. But Tom Cruise said, no, use a real knife.
No.
And I want you to use all the force that you possibly can.
Of course.
I want you to get it to a quarter inch away from my eye as opposed to just like near my eye. And so like this was apparently a battle of will. Like I don't understand it sometimes.
Why?
But I love it. I don't know. I love it.
It didn't look real.
Yeah, like, no one can tell anyway, like,
I don't know if that's just, like, being jaded or something and just, like, seeing what I want to see, but, like, I just assumed, like, I assumed it was digital, and so it looked digital. You know, I assumed it was a CG knife.
I assumed it was, like, a trick of perspective, like, they used a certain lens or something to make it seem like it was, like, right there or something, but I don't know what that adds. I mean, maybe for him.
I think that's great, or, I don't know, it's something that he'd... that he did that, but yeah, I just wish it looked better, or looked, I don't know, it was more clear that it like was for sure the real thing.
It's so strange because I never really consider things like that stunts in movies. They just go by so fast, or I'm just like, oh, that's just, you know, a prop, and you know, like, I don't even think a real stuntman would consider using like a real knife to stage a fight.
No.
You know, like, it's just so bizarre at that level. It's like,
Mike, do you have any other notes, any other thoughts about Mission Impossible 2 before we ask a couple very important questions and nominate this for some awards?
There's one point. It's not my like least favorite point, but it's when when I threw my arms up in the air and just said, okay, movie, like, I love you and you win. When they're sort of in the tunnels and stuff and he's doing his Night Monkey stuff, like, I feel like he's like Night Monkey from Far From Home in parts of this movie, where he's like sneaking around in the dark in that little like black sweatsuit with the mask and everything. But it's like during that part, and at one point he manages to like knock out the dude's bodyguard and make a mask of himself and the dude's bodyguard and like do the old maskaroo switcheroo dealy. And when, like, it's all off screen and he like kind of drags himself back into the room, and then the bad guy shoots Tom Cruise in the leg, but it's not Tom Cruise. I didn't see any mask making machine packed into his gear thing. We do get one of those, I think, in like the next movie or something.
I assumed he planned ahead, like that was...
Well, that's what eventually I was like, well, I get that that was his plan, and I accept it, don't get me wrong. Like, I think it's kind of hilarious. Believe it or not, that's the moment where my suspension of disbelief kind of walked away. It was just like, they better not go any further.
It's so worth it for that reveal, though. It's I love how that plays out.
Oh, I love all the ways the mask reveals in this movie actually look so great. You know, especially the one when Sean is like meets Thandi Newton on his own compound and pretends to be Tom Cruise,
yeah.
And he's like really evil looking, and then he takes off his mask, and it turns out he's been fucking crying. Like, he's been crying like under the Tom Cruise mask. And the guard comes up and he's like, what's happening? He's like nothing. Like,
Austin, what about you? Any other final thoughts before we ask a couple very important questions?
No, I'll just say that this whole movie, I was gagging for it. That's a line in the movie.
Yes. That same scene. Okay, so now I think, you know, Mike and I had played this last time. The other Tom, you know, if Tom Hanks were cast in the role of Ethan Hunt, do you think that could have worked, Austin? If not, is there another role in this movie that you think he could have played?
Can't imagine this movie being any different with Tom Hanks in as Ethan Hunt. There's no way he could do this.
I would like to see him as the helicopter pilot. I think that could work. I mean, it's a very small role, but that might work.
That's exactly what I'm saying. You bring in someone like Tom Hanks.
Or the Anthony Hopkins part, or, yeah, some bit part. Why not?
Nowadays, like, the sort of older gray Tom Hanks as the head of IMF would be cool, like replacing the next guy. That would be neat.
Yeah.
A very important question we ask every episode. I don't know if it's yes or not. I would imagine it is, but I can't think of a thing. Does Tom Cruise run in this movie?
Yeah, I think he runs with the pigeons.
Oh, yeah, because he's in the sewers and he's like running up to the dude and he does this crazy like kick like Guile from Street Fighter 2. He does like the flash kick. I was like, holy shit. I expected
so
to see like
in slow motion.
Does that count?
It might be slow motion because if the pigeons were in the shot, it was probably slow motion. But he is interesting. There's definitely a shot of him running surrounded by pigeons.
Now, one other question that, you know, we asked on the cocktail episode, if you remember, there's somebody that we found on Twitter, Harperfect, who said that you can replace Tom Cruise's character name in every movie with the name Lightning McQueen, and not a thing would change. I don't remember. I'm not going to look back at what we said for the first Mission Impossible movie, but Austin, this is up to you. Do you think if we replaced Ethan Hunt's name with Lightning McQueen, this movie would still work, that not a thing would change?
I'm going to say no.
All right.
For this whole series, I think he needs kind of a boring name. Like, I think Ethan Hunt is kind of perfect. Like, he needs something plain. And I think it would actually, like, take something away if he had something so fancy.
All right.
If it would work in any movie, it would maybe be this one because it's the most like over the top. I wouldn't like it. I don't think it's appropriate for this character. I think he has to be Ethan. He could have an alias of Lightning McQueen, but I don't think that could be his name.
All right. Yeah. I like that.
Joey, do you remember from the first movie we found out, I think, is like just by mining the sort of stuff that showed up in the background on TV, his mother's maiden name is Ethan?
Yes.
So he has two last names. His name is Ethan Hunt. His first name is his mother's maiden name. So that's crazy.
That's
that
cool.
Makes it even more boring. It's cool, but I feel like it's even more innocuous. You know, like it's even lamer or something to a degree.
Well, I guess. I don't know. I think that's cool. And I think that informs his character that he was named after his mom. I think that's nice. It explains why.
Nice.
He's, I think he was raised feminist, and he's very respectful to women. He was very disgusted with Anthony Hopkins when he said a misogynistic comment. I don't know. I think that something about that really works for me, him being named after his mom. And I don't know. I just picture him being, like, raised well with good values. and being respectful to women.
The final thing on the show that we have to do is nominate this movie for some awards. I know that we all like it. I don't think that I want to nominate it for Best Film just because we have the first one there. Mm-hmm. We're going to have Fallout there. We might have another one in between.
I like the first one more also, yeah. I think. I mean, I really like this movie more than I was expecting, and I love it, but that first one just is crazy.
I will put down, for now, John Woo for Mission Impossible for Best Director Filmmaker.
Okay.
We have Best Cruise Role already. We have the Ethan Hunt there already. Most Badass Role already have that. So this is an interesting thing, you know. Best Fight. Is there a fight in here that we want to nominate, that we want to put up against all of the fights? Because that end fight is kind of lame.
It's tough. There's not a lot of hand-to-hand combat in this. Like, if you notice, they sort of do the reversal of the safe dive from the first one. They do it into, like, the black laboratory, right? Like, he has to dive from the helicopter down into the thing, and then he sort of has a fight that's like a gunfight straight out of The Matrix. I feel like this movie was sort of, like, bouncing off the success of The Matrix a little bit through all that. But I can't recall, like, any real... Like, he just dismantles people, you know, like Rambo, like, quickly. Like, he doesn't have a chance to fight long. Like, it's just 1-2, and he takes people out.
It's kind of disappointing, I guess, in that regard, isn't it? So,
well, we'll get, like, the epic fight in Fallout soon enough.
Reloading his arms, for sure. Yeah. Best theme song, soundtrack, score, we have the franchise nominated there already. Best car chase race, though, yes, absolutely, right?
Yeah.
Motorcycle versus cute car.
What about the Tandy Newton meet-cute car chase where they almost die? I think.
Yeah, there's that one.
Because that's car and car.
The motorcycle battle.
That was also, I don't know if we said it before, but that was also giving me Fast and Furious vibes of like them racing to see Mia giving birth.
Yeah.
Or like, it's kind of, it's not the stare and drive from Too Fast, but it's kind of the stare and drive.
Dom chases Letty from maybe part 6, is it? Or something? Or 7? 6, I think.
Oh,
right?
It's 6, yeah. When he's racing memories back into her. Best dance scene. He does not dance, unfortunately. I don't think, right?
No.
There is dance, but he doesn't dance. Best outfit wardrobe. I don't think there's anything in here that's necessarily noteworthy.
Oh,
there?
There's like a transition early in the movie that's like the Latin woman dancer who like swipes across the screen for a scene transition.
I don't remember the transition. I know what scene you're talking about, but I don't remember the transition.
It's very early on, and it's just like a screen wipe, and they use this like very like 90s flamenco dancer spinning to like go across the screen. But yeah, I would nominate that for best dance. But that's not him, and you guys don't even remember it, but it's great.
I remember the dance because that's she's dancing there as Thandie Newton steals the necklace. Like, that's what she's using to sort of like, it's kind of almost like, oh, what's that Bruce Willis movie?
Color of Night.
Hudson Hawk?
Yeah, where he thieves to music, right? Like, it's kind of Hudson Hawk.
Would you like to smash a star? Well, what I was thinking was he's looking at this girl and she's looking at him, and then we cut to the dancing. I was like, ooh, they're having a little dance themselves,
ooh,
aren't they?
Ooh, isn't that what's going on? The last tango in Barcelona.
Yeah, so I think the way they cut to that scene is like with this absurd transition that I thought was great.
Best sunglasses. We got to nominate the Oakley Eyes, which are discontinued. You cannot buy those anymore, unfortunately.
Holy shit. But, well, they self-destruct.
Yeah, self-destructing sunglasses for sure.
Best death, he does not die. Best line or best freak out? Is there a line or freak out?
I'm sorry, real quick.
Tom Cruise does die in this movie.
Yeah, like that's what's interesting. Like Ethan Hunt doesn't die, but it's weird to see Tom Cruise die on screen like
all
that.
All right, so I'll say masked. I'll put in quotes, masked enemy shot to death.
I don't think it's going to survive the call when we wipe this list
down. But, you know,
it's worth
keeping around, yeah.
It's cool because, it's like a fake-out kill or death. Or I don't know. It was just
well, because we also have... So we have 5 deaths right now, including that one. 2 of them are from Interview with the Vampire, which he cannot die. They're just killers he's trying to kill. And he's only actually died in 2 movies. One of which I forgot that he died in, so... Whew.
Oh, man, and when we get to Edge of Tomorrow...
Can I ask which two does he die in?
He dies in Taps, because he's a psychopath who, like, leads a rebellion against
militia,
the army.
Basically. Yeah.
And they shoot him and kill him. And then he dies in Far and Away. A horse falls on him and rolls over him, and he dies.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Wait, no, but then he comes back to life.
Oh, because so we got to put a little star there, too. God damn it.
So, Austin, they're, like, racing to get land and stuff, and at the end, like he beats this guy and he gets the land, and then, like, a horse runs over him, I think. Like, a whack? I don't know. But he's dying, and then, like, the camera literally is, like, bird's eye view drifting away from him, and then, like, she kisses him, and the camera, like, swoops back down into his face,
oh,
and he comes back to life.
It's wonderful. I love that movie.
He's died 5 times, but actually stayed dead once.
Wow. Okay.
Which is amazing. That is, you know, yeah. If that's not a testament to the power of Scientology, I don't know what is.
Yeah, I guess you just gotta, like, give that to Edge of Tomorrow, since that's...
Right? Oh, God, yeah.
He like, still doesn't stay dead, but at least, like, he's dying in the movie.
That is insane. Like, he must be the most acting actor who's died but not really been killed. I don't know. There's some weird stat going on.
Sean Bean can't not die, and Tom Cruise can't not come back to life.
Yeah, there's tons.
There it is.
Clint Eastwood, I think, has only died in, like, 2 movies out of, like, 100. I think it's 2 movies that he's died in.
You know, when we did Cage Club, when we were keeping track of deaths, like, I feel like Cage died kind of an appropriate amount of time, because I feel like a lot of movies, the leading man just does not die because they can't look weak or whatever, right? But, like, they occasionally are killed, especially early on. Cage was killed, but then there's like a long stretch where he didn't die, that I feel like lately,
oh yeah,
he's died in like a rapid, like a wild disproportionate amount of movies. Like, he just, yeah, like, oh no, I'm done, like he just killed me off
and like shot to death, like brutally.
Yeah. Yeah,
executed, I'd say.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. Best line or best freak out is there something in here that you either of you think we should nominate?
Oh man, that Anthony Hopkins line is so perfect. I wish it came out of Tom Cruise.
I know. This is specifically Tom Cruise says a thing.
I know.
Which line?
Where it's not mission difficult.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, okay. I wish like Tom Cruise said that to Ving Rhames later or something. You know, like
I do love that. I thought about that. I think that might have been the only quote that I wrote down.
Well, for me, it's feel better. Him shouting that in her face.
Shouted it in her
that conversation, face. But just, and it's like, I mean, it's almost a freak out too. Like, he really like shouts in her face. Feel
oh,
better.
Oh, I'm putting it under freak outs.
Yeah, it's so good.
Feel better.
Anthony Hopkins was right. That was difficult. I bought it. Like, that's the thing too, is like, I buy their relationship for some reason, like, so wholeheartedly that, like, I really, like you said also, like, I wanted to see her back.
Yeah.
It's so weird at the end of this movie. I mean, like, why do I feel like they belong together? I don't care.
Because it was done. It's just charming. It's a very, like, charming fling, yeah. I guess, but yeah, as a relationship or whatever, it's just, I love it.
Is the sex scene he has with Thandi Newton, is it worth nominating for best sex scene or no?
No, it's like the worst. We don't even see it. They just like wake up,
yeah,
next
they
to
just
each
wake
other.
Up together.
Like the sex scene is the car chase, you know, like that's, yes, that's the sex.
Well, that's the foreplay. That's just, you know,
yeah,
like,
I guess,
yes,
yeah, right.
Yeah, or them in the bathtub rolling around.
There's a lot of build-up, right? And then the actual release is just, I don't know. Most athletic feat, obviously free soloing a mountain.
Oh, my God,
Mission Impossible,
yeah,
too.
I mean, even, you know, that had ropes, even knowing that he was, yeah, guy, whatever, like, doesn't matter, like, still amazing.
They had to lie, like, he lied to the studio. He's just like, oh, I'm not gonna, yeah, do that, and then he actually did that, because they're like, no, we need a double, you know. And then he basically said, I think he said it again, like, in Fallout, like, I think probably in all the movies, he's like, no, people can tell when it's not me, and they want him to look real, I want him to look good, I'm going to do this myself. And John Woo's like, all right, man, do whatever you gotta do, because I'm not gonna be, like, well, you're higher up on the food chain than I am, basically.
That's what I heard, was that John Woo said it was sort of like sprung on him, not the day of, but like Tom Cruise came to him and was like, yeah, so like, we're gonna figure out how I'm gonna do this. And he's like, okay. Like, he's kind of not like, you're the boss, but he's like, like, he wanted to help him do it, you know what I'm saying? Like, they were in it together, I think. But like, yeah, that's, it was just like kind of a secret, I guess, to the studio. Just like insane now when you think about it. Like, could have, yeah, lost Tom Cruise. Like, oh well.
Best running scene, nothing of particular note to nominate here. Best or worst love story?
Yeah. Best love story.
what have we had so far? I mean, most of it's been with his wife. I feel like we gotta get a couple else in here. Like, I like this. Yeah,
no, we don't even have so best love story right now so far, Jack and Lily in Legend.
What? No, that's gonna go.
We have Jerry and Dorothy in Jerry Maguire.
All right,
and
that's
we
a
have
tough one to beat.
We have Maverick and Goose, or Maverick and Iceman in Top Gun.
Oh, okay. So yeah, this has to get in there. I like this one. Yeah.
And then for worst, we have Bill and Alice in Eyes Wide Shut, and then we have Brian and Jordan in Cocktail.
Oh, okay.
Oh my God, that relationship, Brian and Jordan.
Yeah, that was a bad
one. They're going to have twins, those two. Oh, dear.
Best ensemble cast, I'm going to say no, because I feel like there are better ensemble casts in other Mission Impossible movies. Like,
This movie actually feels kind of small on that scale.
It does.
I don't know.
They intentionally dialed back, right?
Well, yeah, it feels like they really wanted to showcase Tom Cruise, because I have no idea who like half the people are in this movie. Like, I didn't know who Tandy Newton was. I didn't know who the guy playing the bad guy was. I didn't. You know what I'm saying? I knew Anthony Hopkins, obviously, and Ving Rhames, but like that's literally like who's this Billy actor? You know, like it really just feels like he's supposed to stand out and get recognized.
And then the final thing, best non-Cruise actor, male or female. Do we want to nominate anybody, Thandi Newton or somebody else? I mean, I don't know if she's really in, I don't know if she has enough to do to really, you know, recognize her.
I loved their relationship, and I really liked her character in the first half. I don't know if it's, I necessarily came away from it like impressed by their performance. You know, I just kind of like the character. I think Ving Rhames can just always be nominated.
Oh yeah, we have Luther as in the franchise. We have that from the first one. We knew that he was going to stick around, so we made sure to give him his due.
I don't know if she necessarily earns a, you know, best non-Cruise actor.
I think she gets close, and then like her character just kind of drops out of the movie, unfortunately.
Yeah, she injects herself with the virus. She's like, I'm gone.
But also, like, it's kind of very much like they probably wouldn't do this in a new Mission Impossible movie where they like have a girl infiltrate the gang. Like, this is very Fast and Furious 2, right, Joey? Where it's like the old flame gets together with either the drug lord or the crook or the thief or something and goes undercover. It's like an old flame kind of situation thing. I don't know if they would, you know, because she's just being used because she's a woman. Like, that's so weird. Like, she's not even because she's a thief. It's because
it's like slightly more active fridging, kind of, right? Right? Like
kind of,
like,
right. Yeah.
Like she's not killed and motivate him, but she's injected and she's used and she's, I guess, you know, the standard plight of a woman in Hollywood. You know what I mean? So, well, 8 awards, not including the ones that we had for the franchise. Best director, filmmaker, 2 for best car chase race, best sunglasses, best death with an asterisk, best freak out, most athletic feat, and best love story. So pretty successful overall for what many consider to be the worst Mission Impossible movie. Very cool, very cool. Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us here tonight. If people want to find you, where can you be found on the internet?
You can find me on Letterboxd or Instagram. And yeah, you can look up my movie review cinema stories series on YouTube, like 3-minute movie reviews, and they're good, I think. I don't know.
Now, I heard that there were rumblings last time that after you asked for money on Venmo, did somebody pay you money on Venmo?
Oh yeah, I forgot to give that plug, that I am on Venmo if you want to send me money. And yeah, Joey sent me $1. So,
that's our standard pay for guests.
That's just what you pay every guest. It's $1.
To be honest, you know, Mike and I have done, I don't know, 500, what, say 500 episodes, right? Like, no one has ever asked for money before. You're the first person to ask to get paid, so.
I'm not asking to be paid for the podcast. I'm asking
But you're just asking to be paid in general.
I'm asking for free money for nothing.
So I want that dollar back, because I paid you for the podcast. I didn't pay you just for nothing. I paid you for the podcast. So I guess, you know, if you find it in your heart to give me that dollar back, at some point I'll give you $1 for nothing. Or did you already spend it?
Yes, I already spent it.
All right.
That's my big plug is just, you know, if you enjoyed my appearance on this podcast, or if you didn't, or if you're just listening to this part, you know, yeah, send me a few bucks.
Oh, a few bucks?
No, I mean, I said that last time. I will accept any amount. You cannot give me enough money.
But, oh, okay.
But you can't,
okay.
I mean, there's no wrong amount either. $1 was really great to receive.
Well, Mike, next time we have a movie called Vanilla Sky, the American remake of Abre los Ojos, which I don't remember much about, but we have a couple exciting first-time guests on either one of the Tom Tom episodes. So next episode, some big, new, shiny new things.
And returning director Cameron Crowe's Counting Cameron Crowe.
You know what I realized? We were a couple weekends ago. I was up in a cabin in the woods for my friend's birthday party.
What did you guys choose out of the cellar?
Read Latin. It was a very bad idea. Actually, the cellar there is locked, so we can't even get down there, which I guess is probably for the best. But anyway, there was a bunch of DVDs there because the internet was bad and there was no TV, and so they just had a bunch of DVDs. So at night, you know, after we had drank all day and eaten meat all day and, you know, been outside, whatever, come inside, put on some movies, play some cards or whatever. Speaking of Cameron Crowe, I put on Almost Famous. It was too good of a movie. Like, people just, like, stopped what they were doing and just watched the movie. And I was like, oh, this is... It backfired. It's just like, this was not what I think it was also, like, the second night. People were tired. They were sleepy, whatever. But people were just like... Oh, I'm just gonna watch the movie. It's like, this isn't what I wanted at all. Like, I just want the background noise. And then people are like, oh, this is good. Which, yes, it is, but come on, guys.
You should have put on one of the two copies of Mr. Magorium's Magic Emporium that are up at the cabin. That's a Breaking Bad final season. Oh. When he's at the cabin, that's like two DVDs that Robert Forrester brings, and it's like,
oh,
both,
yeah.
Mr. Magorium's Emporium.
Well, so for all things Mr. Magorium's Wonder Emporium, go to cageclub.me, facebook.com/cageclub, or at cageclubpod on Twitter and Instagram. Email us, run@cageclub.me. Come back in 2 weeks for Vanilla Sky. Come back on our Hanks for the Memories episode, our Tom Hanks podcast, next week for Sleepless in Seattle. Check out our last episode over there of A League of Their Own, available now. And we will see you soon for Vanilla Sky, you know, everything in its right place, the Radiohead song to kick it off. I'm Joey Lewandowski.
And I'm Mike Manzi.
And that was Austin Wolf Southern of Venmo. And we will see you soon right here on Cruise Club.